Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
All right, Entree Architect community, welcome to the backstage area of Context and Clarity. Every Thursday afternoon on Context and Clarity Live, Catherine McPhail and I, and our live audiences that are joining us from all across the internet, we get to talk to a special guest to search for clarity around the things that matter most to you, the architect, no matter what your context is. You may be the employee of a firm that's dreaming of doing your own thing, or you may have had your own firm for a year or 10 years or 20 years, and you're starting to rethink or reimagine what that firm could or maybe even should be. Every week, we cover topics that fall under the broad umbrella of the business of architecture, and they're all the need-to-know topics for the success of entrepreneur architects just like you. If we've never met before, my name is Jeff Eccles, and what you're about to listen to is the audio recording of a conversation that my co-host, Catherine McPhail, and I had to break down this week's Context and Clarity Live conversation. So thanks for joining us as we share our biggest takeaways and look for ways to apply what we heard in the Context and Clarity Live conversation to our own businesses. In this episode, we talked with Emily Sikorsky. Emily is a co-author of the book Rooting Up, Essays on Modern Branding, a co-founder and the CEO of the brand strategy firm Root and River, and also a speaker for the upcoming Entree Architect Community Annual Meeting. Now, if you know me, you know that branding, brands are topics that I love to go deep in the weeds on, and I really geek out on them. And I really love Emily's perspective on brand strategy. We started this conversation with her definition of brand and talked all the way through to the question of, what do you do with this thing called a brand? Where and how do I use it? I'd call that brand activation. This is a topic that I know challenges many architects, but I think that we were able to wrap up almost all of our audience questions into this conversation as well. So I hope that after you listen, you come away with some clarity about what might have seemed like some pretty murky water. Catherine McPhail joined me once again for both the conversation with Emily Sikorsky and backstage afterward. Catherine is my co-host, and she's an architect and a podcaster in Fairhaven, Massachusetts. In addition to Context and Clarity, Catherine hosts Talking Home Renovations with the House Maven, and she's the CEO of Demios Architects. As always, I'm looking forward to talking about our takeaways from the conversation. So let's go backstage and listen in as Catherine and I talk about our conversation with Emily Sikorsky, brand strategist, co-founder, and CEO of Root and River.
You know, what's interesting is that having the idea of a post-pandemic brand is, it just struck me that every single person on the entire earth just went through this pandemic or is going through the pandemic. So it's an actual marker of time and a time during which a lot of people's lives changed. So it's an event that would require us to think about things and change during the whole thing. So anyway, I just realized that.
As you're describing that, I don't know why this popped into my head, but I thought about trees. You know, when you look at the rings of a tree, you can look at it and go, okay, well, these rings are evenly spaced, or these rings are close together, or these rings are far apart, and you can sort of track history environmental things, you know, that affect the tree in that way. And I think that's a really good way to think about it, an interesting way to think about it, because how often do we have something, and maybe thankfully we don't that often have something where we all go through something that makes us reevaluate things on the level that we have, as we've gone, you know, from basically the middle of March 2020 until now. But, you know, in talking with Emily, and one of the questions was, do brands evolve? And I was curious about that because she is going to be talking about post-pandemic brands, which I think implies, you know, or how do we think differently? As you said, how do we think differently about everything that we do? And she said that basically the foundation probably won't change that much, but the way that we want to work and the way that we want to be seen and, you know, the way that we interact in our clients, we may be thinking differently about that. And so that may affect some change in the future. So I was really looking forward to this conversation because I knew there'd be some fascinating aspects of the, you know, for me that geeks out on brand and branding and things. I knew that there would be some nuances to really dig into.
I think generally speaking, we as small architects, sole proprietor architects, hadn't necessarily thought much about our brand before the pandemic. And I'm trying to think about if that's true. It might have been about maybe a year before that I started thinking about it. But then obviously hanging out with you every day during the pandemic, it's been more on the top of our minds, I would say. Maybe more than the typical architect out there. I'm not sure what the rest of the architects are going through. But there is still some resistance to the idea or understanding of the idea of brand, I feel like.
I definitely think that there is still resistance. You know, I think the number one reason is lack of understanding, you know, what a brand is. And that's why I started out the first question with Emily in our conversation was, you know, what is a brand? And one of the things that Emily talked about was experience. You know, what is the experience of, essentially, what is the experience of working with you? You know, if you're a small firm, a medium-sized firm, any, you know, sole practitioner or whatever, what's the experience of working with you?
It begins with an inward journey to really uncover what we believe and pull it all the way through the client experience, which I think as business owners or as people who are really as a creative field, I consider myself creative as well. You're very consumed, right, by what's in front of you. But it's branding, the act of branding, the process of branding begins with sort of a pull the car over moment and this deep dive. And instead of fixating on, you know, one part of it, it's like taking a look at into what we call the soil of soul to determine what is it that I really truly believe that's powering me every day as a human being. And then how is that showing up in the work that I'm doing, the work that we as a team are doing, naming those things and getting kind of consensus around them, and then pulling that through to say, okay, now how is that showing up in the client experience, or how is that showing up in the process that I've created? And so it's very rare that we take a step back to actually get intentional about what's there, and then start to pull it through. A lot of times we just start on the other end, like, oh, I want my clients to feel this way. And so we're like, okay, how can we create that feeling? But it's so much more effective and sustainable when you begin with the foundation work and you know, no, I consistently want to make people feel, I want to be a reflection of my deep belief in beauty. Right? I want everything to do to reflect that. And that's one of my core beliefs. So how can I infuse beauty into everything that we do, that we touch?
I really liked hearing her definition because my default is to fall back to that definition. I repeat this over and over and over, that whether you want to attribute it to Marty Neumeier or Jeff Bezos, it's that definition that your brand is what other people say about you when you're not in the room. And when she gave her definition, and part of that definition, like I said, was about experience, I think those things mesh, especially for architects. I think those mesh really, really well, because when someone has hired you, someone has worked with you as an architect, what are they going to talk about? Are they going to talk about the house that you designed? Sure, of course they are. Are they going to talk about what it's like to live in that house, or, you know, whatever it is that you design, whatever types of projects you do? They are. But when pressed, you know, if we think about this in terms of marketing and business development, I need these clients to refer other people to me. I need these clients to convince other people, or reassure other people that, yeah, I might be the right service provider for them. So what that eventually is going to come down to is not the house, not what it's like to live in the house, but what it was like to work with you. It's that experience piece of it. Because you could, this is one of the things that just, it boggles my mind, is the way I'm going to say it right now. It boggles my mind all the time when I talk to an architect and I say, what makes you different? And they say, well, the quality of our design is what makes us different. And I hate that answer. You can't quantify it. It's completely subjective. And the problem is that unless someone can look at a project, and I guess in this example, specifically your project, and say, oh, I know exactly who designed that.
Right. But a lot of times it doesn't happen because maybe you're just, in my case, each of them are different types of houses, different types of people, and they want different types of spaces. So I don't have a signature addition that I add to people's houses.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Unless you have an identifiable signature style, which, you know, let's be real, the Starkitects, right? If you look at a building that Zaha, or, you know, the firm that continues on after her that carries her name, if you look at a building, Zaha, if you look at the Oculus in Manhattan, in the financial district of Manhattan, right next to the 9/11 memorial, if you know architecture, you know that's Calatrava. If, you know, you look at something that Gehry did, you know that's Gehry. But beyond, you know, that level of Starkitect or Starkitecture or whatever it is, that, you know, that idea doesn't hold true for 99.9% of firms out there. And it comes back to, here's the problem is, if someone wants Calatrava, they're going to hire Calatrava. They're not going to go, okay, well, you know, what other local architect? No, they want Calatrava. And so they're going to go hire them. They're going to go hire that firm. And so then it, you know, beyond that point, it comes down to, what is it actually like to work with this person? You know, do they listen to me? Do they, you know, whatever that experience is like. And that's, I think, the reality for the majority of the firms on the planet.
So I have a question for you then, Jeff. So what it's really like to work with me, I may have a specialty or a niche or something like that. So that has something to do with my brand or not anything to do with my brand? It kind of does, but really what it has to do with whether I am rude or whether I am dismissive of people's ideas or whether I write back in a timely fashion for emails. I mean, was that what you're saying? Like, basically I can say whatever I want about my style and my specialty, but if I am hard to work with, that's what my brand is?
I think that's part of it. Yeah. I mean, think about how people make decisions, right? And again, if you know, they're sort of, I don't know how we want to define it, but call it elite level branding. You know, if there's a brand that you would walk into a grocery store and recognize, right, that's sort of transcended a lot of things. Like, oh, I know that brand. You see it on a billboard or something like that, you can identify with it. Well, most architects are not at that level. So, because they're also not foods or household products, but when we make a decision about a service provider, and it could be an architect, it could be an attorney, it could be whatever, you know, how do we do that? Okay, well, I need an architect that can design an addition to my home or a new home or whatever it is that I need. So now I can make a list. Here are 15 architects that do that kind of work. Here are five that are near me. What do I know about any of these? You know, imagine someone's Googling, and I'm not 100% convinced that people are Googling to find the architect that they want. They're probably asking more people. And this is where it really becomes important. You know, well, okay, who did your, you know, you go to a party, you love the kitchen, you love the addition, you love whatever it is, and go, oh, wow, who did this? Well, Catherine did that. Oh, wow. What was it like to work with Catherine? You know, think through the natural process that somebody goes through to make a decision. One of the very first questions, because they've already made a judgment. Do I like this? Do I not like this? That's pretty easy. That took them like a millisecond. It was an emotional, it was a visceral reaction to the space, to the design, to the whatever. Okay, yes or no. It's pretty binary at that point. Then what do I want to know? Who did this? What was it like to work with them? And then we're getting into the idea of a brand for an architect. What, you know, that definition that I repeat all the time was, what do people say about you when you're not in the room? You're not at that party, right? You're not in that room. Somebody is talking about what it was like to work with you.
Okay. So this is where I was a little confused yesterday and perpetually confused about this point. So would part of my brand and what I tell people and market myself as someone who's easy to work with, if that's what I want people to think? And then what if I want people to feel like it's easy to work with me, but that hasn't been their personal experience? And obviously that's not, I don't have that much control besides my own behavior over what they think. Or even if they are a little, I have had a couple clients who are a little untethered from reality, I feel like. And they might not have the nicest things to say about me because they might think I'm also untethered from reality because we just weren't seeing the same reality. But as happens sometimes, I don't know, it just feels like there's so little control really over your brand if that's the case.
That's part of it, right? We can do what we can do, but then when we're not in the room, right, and they're saying something, then it's up to them. But my question is always what can we give them? What story can we give them that we want them to tell? And, you know, going back to what Emily talked about, what she was saying is, because she, you know, the name of her firm is Root and River, and it's based on the depth that they like to go to in developing the brand and the messaging for their clients. So, you know, going back to what she said, you do have to create the brand on your side. You know, what do you believe in? You know, creating beauty or whatever those things are. How do you express those things? And one of the things that she talked about, because I asked her about activating the, okay, I have this belief, I have this purpose, I've created this messaging or whatever around it. Now what? Right? How do I get that? If I'm working with Emily, or if you're working with Jeff for that matter, you're saying it out loud and we're putting it on paper, we're putting it on the screen and things like that. But okay, how do we get it out of this working session in front of people who we want to work with? And so she talked about the language, the messaging that's what I would call it on your website. She talked about writing, maybe it's blog posts or I guess to continue, it could be the pages on social media posts, things like that, this consistent language. So we can craft all of those things. And the more consistent we are with that messaging and the more that messaging gets out there and the more people are exposed to that, the more we're going to influence what people say. But It's got to be real, right? It's got to be authentic, and you have to live that out. If I say something, going back to Emily's definition, if I say something, then the experience that my clients have to bear that out, or someone's eventually going to say, this isn't authentic, right? this isn't true. Like you were saying, if, you know, if you say one thing and you have a client that's, you know, from your point of view is unhinged from reality, they're going to say that that experience doesn't match up with that. And I think that also is a nice segue to what Emily talks about. And I completely agree with this, is we want our brands to attract certain people and repel people that we think are unhinged from reality.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So many things that she said that I liked that struck me in a different way that I thought of branding before, that the brand attracts and repels people. Very important. Repulsion is even a little more important. I think I got that impression from her. What would you commit civil disobedience for? And how are you making people feel? Like, how are you making people feel? What do you truly believe? So, but then, yeah, someone had asked in the morning on Clubhouse, what's the difference between a brand and a niche? So how do you communicate what you believe in a tagline, let's say? Is that even possible? Or would you bring, say, I'm a friendly architect who answers emails quickly and specializes in boathouses?
Go back to the point about civil disobedience. I loved it when she talked about that. You know, what would you be willing to commit civil disobedience for? That's the depth to create a really powerful brand that is truly attracting some and repelling others. It can't be just a surface. I'm a really nice architect, right? And I answer emails. It's got to be deep.
Go to a coffee shop, get out of your usual space and start some self-inquiry around, you know, what do I believe in? Here, some questions that we like to ask is, what have you always believed to be true that no one ever taught you? What would you commit civil disobedience to defend? What is something that you are working to instill in your children, the people you mentor, your nieces or nephews? Those kind of questions, like really deep, right? So that, and as you begin to answer those, and as you begin to kind of sink into the truth, the foundational truths of who you are, you can layer on top of that, like, okay, now what am I trying to do through this firm? What kind of design am I, you know, how is this showing up? Or how do I wish, if you're new, how do I wish that it would show up? So those are some good places to start, but I really, even if you do that one by one, so you could start with those values questions and move on to like mission, you know, what is my purpose here? What do I want to add to this industry, to this world, to this community that doesn't exist? And what am I here to do that nobody else can do in my, you know, in the way that I can? And if you find yourself stuck, call a friend, call a buddy, call your life partner and ask them, you know, what do I do best? What kind of, you know, what is it that makes me unique? And just listen and try to take that in.
Those in the audience that may be religious and may, you know, may be familiar with Bible passages will be familiar with the, and I forget exactly how it goes, so forgive me, but the idea that you're, Jesus said, I think you're neither hot nor cold, you're lukewarm and I spew you out of my mouth. I think to me, that's an image that comes into my head. If you're hot, I may like that, or I may not like that. If you're cold, I may like that, or I may not like that. But if you're lukewarm, nobody's going to like that, right? Nobody is. And I think, you know, we could take this way down a line and go, you know, why don't clients see value in what we do? Well, it starts with you being lukewarm, right? If I don't connect with you on a belief level, or, you know, I get to talk in extremes because this is our show. If I don't connect with you on a belief level, then how much value am I going to see in that? Right. You look at brands like Patagonia, and they've been in the news lately because their owner has basically given the company over to environmental causes, which is incredible. But there are incredible stories out of Patagonia where they made decisions that have defied all kinds of consultants and advisors because of what they believe. And because of that level of commitment to what they believe, they have attracted very a very loyal following, a very loyal customer base. So then the question to me is, how do you do that as an architect? It's not by being lukewarm. It's not by, hey, I answer emails in 24 hours. And to your point about the niche, yes, you need to be able to say, I do this, I believe this, and bring the niche into that, right? Because you could have a belief about beauty or something, and that could be applied to residential architecture. It could be applied to a different type of architecture that you don't do. So I think the niche has to be a part of it, in my opinion.
I have a part of my current tagline that I'm thinking of doing says that I work with people who are determined to finish responsible, or I can't explain. Okay. I work with homeowners who are determined to build a responsible renovation. And so responsible is a little judgmental and maybe a little bit heavy handed, but that is the way I feel like responsible could mean a whole bunch of things. And I feel like if they're going to, I mean, it could mean responsible to the environment or the neighborhood or the house or any of that, any of the ways that you can have a responsible, what I feel is a responsible project. So would that be an example, or is that not an example, or is that just me being judgmental of people?
One of the reasons that I like Emily's comment or analogy or whatever about civil disobedience is because I think that does convey the idea that where are you going to plant the flag? Where are you going to make the stand? And it is judgmental. You know, so your question about responsible, is that too judgmental? No, I don't think it's too judgmental at all. Reality tells us that certain people are going to read their own thoughts into what responsible is. And I think that's a great, for you and what you do and what you want to do, I think that's a great place to start the conversation. You know, what does that mean? You know, I'm thinking responsible project, responsible addition. This is what I'm thinking. And then you can get into a much deeper conversation than, you know, starting at another point. And that automatically conveys the value of what you do. I think that's at the heart of it, right? That's when we're willing to take a stand, like a Patagonia or a Southwest Airlines, or, you know, there's a million examples of this. But when we're willing to take a stand, we're automatically taking a value position, you know, in that usage of the, which is automatically going to convey a value position in a different usage of the word.
Sometimes it's scary, I guess, to take a stand as to what you truly believe, because maybe not everybody will like you then, right? But then that's part of the repelling people. Like, you can't really, what I'm trying to say is you can't really repel without offending them a little bit. Otherwise, they wouldn't be repelled.
And that's the point. You know, Emily talked about the fact that people ask all the time, and I get this too, you know, what's the ROI? What's the ROI? What's the return on investment in going through this branding exercise, or, you know, paying you, you know, I don't have any idea what Root and River charges for their different levels of service, but, you know, what's the ROI of paying you tens of thousands of dollars to go through this process? Well, part of the ROI is if we create a brand, if we define and develop a brand that repels certain people, one of the things that you get to do is say no less, or be in a position of having to say no, which we all know, you and I know, Emily said it, many of us in this community say it, we don't like to say no. We're here to serve people. Many of us are people pleasers and so on and so forth. Part of the ROI is not having to wade through all of these conversations with people that we know we should say no to, and maybe we don't say no to. And as you know, and much of our audience knows, I've got some horrific stories about projects and people that I should have said no to. And so that's part of it. Yes, it is hard and it is uncomfortable. I guess I would think about it this way. If I get uncomfortable now, right? If I get uncomfortable now and develop a brand that repels certain people, how much discomfort does that save me in the future?
For sure, it does. Yeah. And I think actually after you make a stand like that and you feel like, well, this is me, when I say something that I feel is unbelievable and I can't believe I'm saying this, after a while, after I've said it however many times, I believe it. So it the discomfort goes away. It's just an initial getting used to me declaring what I actually believe. That's my own personal experience. But then it's, you're right. And it saves me a lot of pain later.
It's easy to say, right? It's easy for us to say it in this conversation. Uncomfortable, definitely. Harder to do, definitely. You know, I've told the story of my friend Joe numerous times in different context and clarity conversations about, you know, him wearing everything on his sleeve, including his views on religion and politics and music. And, it, you know, and I have described him as looking like a thin Jerry Garcia. And people in the real estate world, which is, you know, where he operated for a couple of decades, going, hey, you're going to need to shave and you're going to need to dress like a professional and you're going to need to quit talking about these things. And his insistence that, no, this is me. And I want to work with people that are okay working with me and either agreeing with my beliefs or being willing to talk about these things and all of these types of things. And, you know, for all of the naysayers at one point in time, and I don't know if this still holds the record or not, but at one point in time, he had the single largest residential real estate transaction in the history of the state of Indiana. And how do you describe them? Like the fancy, fancy condo buildings in the Conrad Hilton downtown, right? He, you know, and so that was him looking like a thin Jerry Garcia, talking all the time on social media and other places about politics, about religion, you know, all of these things, wearing, you know, being Joe, taking that stand and insisting that he would only work with people that were okay with all of that. And he, you know, I don't even remember the numbers anymore, but it was, you know, multi-million dollar real estate transaction that was not scared off because he took that, or those stands, I guess, you know, that was his civil disobedience, right? That's what he was willing to be civilly disobedient about.
Well, good for Joe.
Yeah.
You know, I think about I wasn't alive in the 50s, but I think about the 50s as being a time when people weren't really as encouraged as they are now to be themselves.
Right.
Can you imagine just having to really conform with absolutely everything?
Yeah.
And not differentiate yourself? Anyway, that's a different.
This is a really important conversation for architects and for professional services. And we talked about this the other day on Context and Clarity. What makes you different? Because a lot of clients, and again, I always talk about the spectrum between sophisticated clients and unsophisticated clients. And I'm not trying to demean anybody, but you know, if we say that like the facilities manager at a university is a sophisticated client because they're dealing with architects all the time and dealing with construction and built environment issues all the time, you know, we'll call them a sophisticated client. And then someone that has never and may never again hire an architect, we'll call them an unsophisticated client. So if that's the spectrum, if your clients are towards the unsophisticated end of the spectrum, they don't know, right? They don't know what it's like or what architects do, or they see sameness, right? Well, aren't all architects the same? Or how is an architect different than my nephew that is studying drafting in high school, or my niece that's an interior, self-proclaimed interior designer, or, you know, whatever? They see sameness. And when we see sameness, first of all, it makes it very hard to make a decision, right? If I change the context and I go look at three different cars, not being a huge car guy, I go look at three different cars three different sedans. You know, what's the difference between these? It's very hard for me to make a decision. And I'm most likely in that scenario to go, okay, well, maybe today, as we're speaking, gas prices here in Indiana are about $4.29 a gallon. I might go, okay, let me look at fuel efficiency and price. What are the differentiators? Well, this one has better gas mileage, and it's $5,000 cheaper than that one, and only $1,000 more than that one. Then maybe that's the differentiator. Yeah, and most architects that are listening to this, this part of the conversation horrifies them, because in their mind, they're saying, I'm very different than the nephew in the drafting class or the niece that's the interior designer. And I don't want anybody making a decision simply based on price. So that brings us back to what makes you different.
Well, it's a tricky subject, which is why some people make their whole career about helping people with it.
It absolutely is. And I absolutely love Emily's and Root and River's approach to this. They talk about intrinsic branding and brands being a spiritual experience. And if you can take your brand to that level, it's going to pay dividends.
It is a pretty interesting endeavor trying to craft your image in a way and communicate that and actually get people to think of you in the same way that you'd like them to think of you.
And remember, you have some control, but not total control over that. Yeah, Emily brought up the quote from Maya Angelou that I don't remember the whole quote, but it basically says that people will remember how you made them feel. And I, you know, that's something that architects should really be paying attention to. How are you making your clients feel from the first time they find you through the schematic design and the excitement, through the beginning of construction and that excitement, through the slog of construction, all the way to the point where they move in, right? And they have their housewarming party or whatever it is that their grand opening, you know, whatever that finale is, they're going to remember how you made them feel. And when somebody asks, you know, what was it like? They're going to tell you, about that experience. And that's a big part of your brand. All right. Well, now you know what we thought and what we're going to do with what we learned. But what did you think? What did we miss? I really hope that there was some big takeaway from either the Context and Clarity Live conversation or our breakdown here that will help you with your business. DM me on Instagram or Twitter and let me know what your takeaways are. You can find me on all the socials at @Jeff_Eccles. That's @JEFF_ECHOLS. So send me a message and let me know what your takeaway was. And if you want more conversations like this, subscribe to the Context and Clarity podcast where you're listening right now and leave us an honest review and a rating. Those things really do help us to get the message out and help more architects just like you. Oh, and also now you can follow us on Instagram, as well as get a heads up on everything that's coming up. There, we're @context_clarity. In our next episode, Catherine and I will host Context and Clarity Live again with a new special guest and a new theme for the week. And we'll come right back here, backstage again, to break it all down for you again. There's always something new to look forward to. And if you love content like this, check out Gable Media. It's a multimedia network for people like you that care about the built environment. And it's the home of Context and Clarity. With Gable's growing family of podcasts and video channels, I know that you're going to find something there that interests you. You can learn more at GableMedia.com. That's GABLMedia.com. And finally, if the topic of today's episode is of particular interest to you and you'd like to dig deeper into it, then join me over in the Entree Architect Community Facebook group. That's where every weekday afternoon at 4 p.m. Eastern, I host Context and Clarity Conversations. And we take these topics like this, and we dig deeper. We have a conversation in real time to try to find more clarity around the things that matter most to you. So thanks for listening. I hope our time together has inspired you to think about your community, your practice, and how you can support those around you. Catherine and I will be back for our next episode, and in the meantime, I hope you'll join me and the Entre Architect community on Facebook today at 4 p.m. Eastern, so that we can help each other find more clarity around the topics that matter most, no matter what your context may be.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and this sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.